Chapter 3. The sharper distress of Jack Aubrey's meeting with Admiral Hartley was softened by a sudden spate of mental and physical activity. The Admiralty Court sat on the French vessel he'd captured in the Ionian Sea and condemned it as lawful prize, and in spite of the proctor's swinging fees, this provided him with a comfortable sum of money. Nothing like the fortune required to deal with his horribly complicated affairs at home, but quite enough to remit 10 years' pay to Sophie, begging her not to stint, and to justify him in moving to rather more creditable quarters at Searle's. And, the proper channels having made themselves apparent at this juncture, to lay out the necessary bribes to get work started on the surprise. But a deep sadness remained, not easily driven away by company or even by music, a sadness accompanied by a determination to live hearty while yet he could. When Laura Fielding came to give him his Italian lesson in these more comfortable rooms, therefore, she found him in a startlingly enterprising mood. Despite a heavy day at the dockyard and a great deal of concern about his frigate's knees. Since Jack Aubrey had never deliberately and with malice aforethought seduced any woman in his life, his was not a regular siege of her heart with formal lines of approach, saps and covered ways. His only strategy, if anything so wholly instinctive and unpremeditated deserved such a name, was to smile very much, to be as agreeable as he could, and to move his chair closer and closer. Very early in their recapitulation of the imperfect subjunctive of the irregular verb stare, Mrs. Fielding saw with alarm that her pupil's conduct was likely to grow even more irregular than her verb. She was aware of his motions rather before they were quite clear in his own mind, for she'd been brought up in the free and easy atmosphere of the Neapolitan court, and she'd been accustomed to gallantry from a very early age. Ancient councillors, beardless pages, and a large variety of gentlemen in between had attacked her virtue, and although she'd repulsed the great majority, it was a subject that interested her. She could detect the earliest symptoms of an amorous inclination, and upon the whole she found they didn't differ very much from man to man. But none of her former suitors had been so massive as this, none had had so bright and formidable an eye, and although some had sighed, none had ever chuckled in this disturbing way. The poor lady, worried by her lack of progress with Dr. Maturin, and vexed by the rumours of her misconduct with Captain Aubrey, was in no mood for fooling. She very much regretted the absence of her maid, since Ponto, her usual guardian, was of no use whatsoever in these circumstances. He sat there, smiling at them and beating the ground with his tail every time Captain Aubrey moved his chair a little nearer. They dismissed the imperfect subjunctive with perfect indifference on either side. And Jack, his imagination now somewhat heated, was speaking of the gossip that concerned them. In spite of her imperfect knowledge of English and his want of perfect coherence, she caught the general drift of his remarks, and before he could reach the point of expressing his earnest desire that these rumours should be given a solid foundation, his view that natural justice required such a course, since they'd suffered innocently, she cut him short. "Oh, Captain Aubrey," cried she, "I have a service to beg of you." Mrs. Fielding had but to command, said Jack, smiling at her with great affection. He was at her orders entirely, very happy, delighted, couldn't be more so. "Why, then," she said, "you know I'm a little talkative. The dear doctor has often said so, desiring me to peep down. But, alas, I am not at all writative, at least not in English. English spelling! Corpe de Bacco! English spelling! Now, if I give you a dictation and you write it down in good English, I can use the words when I write to my husband. Very well, said Jack, his smile fading. It was just as he'd feared, and he must have been quite mistaken about the signals. Mr. Fielding was to understand that the excellent Captain Aubrey had saved Ponto from being drowned. Ponto now doted upon Captain Aubrey and ran up to him in the street. Wicked people therefore said that Captain Aubrey was Laura's lover. Should these rumours reach Mr. Fielding, he was to pay no attention. On the contrary, Captain Aubrey was an honourable man who would scorn to insult a brother officer's wife with dishonest proposals. Indeed, she had such confidence in his perfect rectitude that she could visit him without even the protection of a maid. Captain Aubrey knew very well that she would not ply the oar. "Ply the oar, ma'am?" said Jack, looking up from his paper, his pen poised. "Is it not right? I was so proud of it." "Oh, yes," said Jack, "only the word is spelt rather odd, you know." And he wrote, "She would not play the whore," very carefully, so that the letters couldn't be mistaken, smiling secretly as he did so, his frustration and disappointment entirely overcome by his sense of the ridiculous. They parted on excellent terms, and she gave him a particularly friendly look as she said, "You will not forget my party, will you? I have Count Muratori coming with his lovely flute." "Nothing shall keep me away," said Jack, "short of the loss of both legs. And even then there's always a stretcher." "And you will remember it to the doctor," she said. "He'll remember it to himself, I'm sure," said Jack, holding the door open for her. "And if he don't? But there he is," he said, cocking his ear to the stairs. "He often comes up more like a herd of mad sheep than a Christian when he's in a hurry." Dr. Maturin it was. And his face, ordinarily pale, grave and withdrawn, shone pink with haste and happiness. "Why, you're all wet!" they both cried. And indeed a little pool was fast gathering at his feet as he stood there before them. Jack was on the point of asking, "Did you fall in?" But he didn't like to expose his friend, since the answer must necessarily be yes. Dr. Maturin was wonderfully unhandy at sea, and very often in clambering from boat to ship, or even in stepping from a solid stone-built quay into a motionless Geyser, a local craft expressly designed for the safe, dry transport of landlubbers, he would contrive to miss his footing and plunge into the sea, so much so that his small clothes and the skirts of his coat ordinarily showed whitish tide marks where the salt had dried. Laura Fielding had no such inhibitions, however, and her "Did you fall in?" came out as naturally as the day. "You're most devoted, ma'am," said Stephen, absent-mindedly kissing her hand. "Jack, give me joy. The dromedary's come in." "What of it?" said Jack, who'd seen the slab-sided transport beating up tack upon tack since early dawn. "She has my diving bell aboard."
"What diving bell?"
"My long-awaited Halley's diving bell. I'd almost lost hope of it, so I had. It has a window at the top. I am with child to plunge. You must come and see it at once. I have a Geyser at the waterside." "Gentlemen, good day," said Mrs. Fielding, who was not accustomed to being slighted for a diving bell. They begged her pardon. They were extremely sorry. They'd meant no disrespect. And Stephen handed her down the stairs, with Jack and Ponto following solemnly. "It's Halley's model, you know," said Stephen, as the long, lean Geyser shoved off and began to skim across the Grand Harbour towards the dromedary, urged by the promise of double fare. "How briskly these worthy creatures do propel the bark, to be sure. And have you noticed that they stand up to do so? That they face the direction they're going, like the gondoliers of Venice? Surely this is a laudable practice that should be introduced into the Navy."
Stephen often put forward ideas for the improvement of the service. In his time, he had advocated the serving out of a modest allowance of soap, the cutting of the monstrous rum ration, the provision of free, warm, serviceable uniform clothes for the lower deck, particularly for the ship's boys and new hands, and the abolition of such punishments as flogging round the fleet. These proposals had met with little more success than his present suggestion that, in defiance of all tradition, the Navy should look where it was going. Jack swept straight past it, saying eagerly, "Halley? Comet Halley, the Astronomer Royal?" "Just so. I knew he commanded the Paramore Pink when he was working on the Southern Stars and the Atlantic charts," said Jack, "and I have an amazing respect for him, of course. Such an observer, such a calculator. But I had no idea he was concerned with diving bells. Yet I told you of his paper, The Art of Living Underwater and the Philosophical Transactions, and you commended my desire to walk upon the bottom of the sea. You said it would be a better way of finding lost anchors and cables than creeping for them with a grapnel. I remember it perfectly. But you didn't mention Dr. Halley's name, and you spoke of some kind of a helmet with tubes, no more. I certainly mentioned Dr. Halley's name, so I did, and I treated the bell at some length, but you did not attend. You were playing cricket at the time. You were watching out. Then I came and stood by you. That was on another occasion when we were playing the Gentlemen of Hampshire. I had to desire Babington to lead you away. I've never been able to make you understand how seriously we take the game in England. However, pray tell me again, what is the principle of the bell?" "It's beautiful in its simplicity. Imagine a truncated cone open at the bottom, furnished with a stout glass window at the top, and so weighted that on being lowered into the sea it sinks perpendicularly. A commodious bell, whose occupant sits at his ease upon a bench diametrically placed a little above the lower rim, enjoying the light that shines upon him from the glass above, and revelling in the wonders of the deep. You will object that as the bell sinks, the air within becomes compressed, and the water rises proportionably," said Stephen, holding up his hand. "And in ordinary circumstances this is profoundly true, so that at 33 feet the bell would be half full. But you are also to imagine a barrel similarly weighted and provided with a hole at the bottom and another at the top. The top hole has a leathern hose fitted to it, an airtight, watertight leathern hose, well dressed with oil and beeswax, while the bottom hole is open to let the sea in as the barrel sinks. What's the good of that? Why, don't you see, it replenishes the bell with air." "Not at all. The air's rushed out by way of your leathern hose." The remark struck Stephen dumb. He opened his mouth, then closed it, and for some minutes, as the slim boat ran fast through the ships and small craft in the Grand Harbour, with the noble mass of the three cities ahead and Valletta astern, the air itself blew from the high and brilliant sky, he puzzled over the problem. Then his face cleared, the delight came back, and he cried, "Why, of course, what a brute beast I am. I quite forgot to say that the leathern hose is kept below the lower bunghole by an appended weight. It's kept down during the barrel's descent. That is of the essence. And the man inside the bell grasps it, pulls it in, and raises it. As soon as he's raised it above the surface of the water in the barrel, the confined air rushes into the bell with great force, refreshing him and repelling the sea in the lower part of the machine. He then gives a signal, and as the first barrel is hauled up, so another comes down. Dr. Halley says, and these, Jack, are his very words, an alternate succession furnished air so quick and in so great plenty that I have myself been one of five who have been together at the bottom in 9 or 10 fathom water for above an hour and a half at a time without any ill effects. Five people? Cried Jack. God love me, it must be a most enormous affair. Pray, what are its dimensions? Oh, said Stephen, mine's only a modest bell, a small little bell indeed. I doubt you could get into it. What does it weigh? Shall I forget the exact figure, but very little at all, only just enough to make it sink, and sink slowly at that. Will you look at that bird? Almost directly ahead, at some 35 degrees of elevation, I believe it to be a hangi. They're said to be peculiar to this island. It was clear that the dromedary's people were already used to Dr. Maturin. They lowered a quarter ladder as soon as the Dagaiza came alongside, and when he came labouring up it, two powerful seamen took him by the arms and lifted him bodily over the rail. They also seemed quite attached to him, for in spite of their more urgent official tasks, they'd already cleared away his bell and its appurtenances, and the transport's master, accompanied by several of the crew, all smiling, led the visitors forward to see it. "There she lays," said the master, nodding at the main hatchway, all ready to be hoisted out. "You'll see, sir, that I followed Dr. Halley's instructions to the letter. There's the sprit stayed to the masthead, and there are the braces to carry her with outboard and within according, and Joe here has given the brass a rub, so she'll not look paltry." She looked very far indeed from paltry. The broad brass ring surrounding the bell's glass top was over a yard across, and it gazed up at them like the eye of an enormous, expectant, cheerful, simple-minded god. Jack returned its gaze with a sinking heart. "It seems quite large in that confined space," said Stephen. "But that's an optical illusion. When it's pulled up, you'll see that it's remarkably small. 3 foot 6 across the top, 5 foot across the bottom, 8 foot deep," said the master with great satisfaction. "Holds nigh on 60 cubic foot and weighs 3,900 weight odd pounds. Jack had meant to take his friend aside and tell him privately that it would not do, that the machine would be obliged to be set ashore or sent home. That Jack was tolerably fly, not having been born yesterday, and was not to be taken in by a fait accompli. But these very shocking figures so startled him that he cried, "God help us! 5 foot across, 8 foot high, close on 2 ton? How can you ever have supposed that room could be attempted to be made for such a monstrous thing on the deck of a frigate?" All around him the smiling faces turned grave and closed, and he was aware of a strong current of moral disapproval. The dromedaries were obviously on Stephen's side. "To tell the truth," said Stephen, "I engaged for it when you had the Worcester. But even in a 74, where could it conceivably go?" Stephen had thought that it might prove an acceptable ornament upon the poop, where it would be ready to be launched, or rather roused over the side, whenever the ship wasn't actively engaged. "The poop? The poop?" began Jack. But this was no time for a description of the horrid effects of a wind-resistant 2 tons perched so far aft and so high above the centre of gravity, and he went on, "But there's no question of a ship of the line. We're speaking of a frigate, and a small frigate at that. And perhaps I may be permitted to observe that no frigate yet built has ever had a poop." "Why, that being so," said Stephen, "what do you say to the convenient little space between the foremast and the front rail?" 2 tons right over our forefoot, pressing on our narrow entry? It'd make an angel gripe. It'd cut 2 knots off our rate of sailing on a bowline. Besides, there's the mainstay, you know, and the downhauls, and how should I ever win my anchors? No, no. Doctor, I'm sorry to say it'll never do. I regret it, but had you spoken of it earlier, I should have advised against it directly. I should have told you at once that it would never do in a man of war, except perhaps in a first rate, that might just find room for it on the skids.
It is Dr. Halley's model,
said Stephen in a low voice.
But on the other hand, said Jack with an unconvincing cheerfulness, think what a boon it would be to a shore establishment. Lost cables, hawsers, anchors, and I'm sure the port admiral would lend you a broad-bottomed scow from time to time to look at the bottom with. For my part, I shall always acknowledge a great debt to Dr. Halley whenever I take the altitude of a star, said the master of the dromedary. All mariners must be grateful to Dr. Halley, said his mate. And this seemed to be the general opinion aboard. Well, sir, said the master, turning to Stephen with a most compassionate air, what am I to do with your poor bell, with poor Dr. Halley's bell? Set it ashore as it stands, or take it to pieces and strike it down into the hold until you've considered it in your mind? One or the other I must do to clear my hatchway, and double quick, you see, for the lighters will be putting off the moment the clerk of the check reaches Admiralty Creek. There he is, just by Edinburgh over there, nattering with her skipper. Pray take it to pieces, Captain, if that shouldn't be too laborious, said Stephen. I have some friends in Malta, upon whose attachment I believe I can rely. No trouble at all, sir. A dozen bolts, and Bob's your uncle, if you'll excuse the expression. If it takes to pieces, said Jack, the case is altered. If it takes to pieces, it may come aboard and travel below, being put together on suitable occasions, during dead calms, or in port, or when the ship is lying to. I shall send my barge at once. It's an odd thing, he reflected as the Dagaiza skimmed towards the dockyard. But if I'd been standing on my own quarter-deck, they would never have presumed to prate about Dr. Halley. I felt like Julian the Apostate in the midst of a bench of bishops. Should have dismissed it out of hand aboard my own ship. Authority very much a matter of place. Meek in my father's house, most people are, I dare say. Yet his own daughters were not outstandingly meek. He thought of their shrill bawling. Oh, Papa, Papa, do come on, Papa. We shall never get up the hill at this rate. Pray, Papa, don't be such a slug. Early it would have been goddamn slug, they having caught a free way of speaking from the seamen who formed part of the household. But since the last voyage or two, Sophie'd taken the matter in hand, and now girlish cries of infernal swab or short-arsed cullion were to be heard only in the remoter parts of Ashgrove Wood. "I wonder what Graham will give us," said Stephen, speaking suddenly from the silence. "Something good, I'm sure," said Jack, smiling. Professor Graham was known to be careful of his pennies, but those who called him parsimonious, illiberal, avaricious, niggardly, penurious, near, close, or mean were mistaken. And when he gave a feast, in this case a farewell dinner to his former shipmates of the Worcester and the Surprise, and to some friends and relations in the Highland regiments, he did so very handsomely indeed. "It'll be strange if you don't get a spotted dog. He particularly asked me to tell him your favourite dishes. I shall look forward to that." His voice rose effortlessly to an enormous volume as he called out, "Come athwart my hawse, and I shall ride you down, you half-baked son of an Egyptian fart!" to a wool-gathering jolly boat. An art echoed from either shore. "But now I come to think of it," he went on, "I have a mind to pull over to the Edinburgh and borrow Dundas's launch. It's remarkably beamy, much more suitable than our barge. And since he's lying in 10 fathom water, much more suitable than Surprise's fetid puddle, I make no doubt he'll clap a tackle under your bell and give you a dip. Though it might be as well to let a ship's boy or a midshipman go down first to make sure it works." "Professor Graham, sir, a good evening to you," said Dr. Maturin, walking into his colleague's room. "I am come from walking on the bottom of the sea."
"Aye,"
said Graham, looking up from his papers.
So I understand. They were watching you from the Baraka with perspective glasses bubbling away in your inverted cauldron. Colonel Viole, 2.5-1, you'd never come up again.
I trust with all my heart he lost, the inhuman wretch.
Of course I did, since you're here, said Graham impatiently. But you're being facetious again, no doubt. The bottom of the sea must have been a sad, stinking, muddy place to judge from your shoes and stockings.
So it was, too. A great stretch of yellowish-grey mud rippling away in that wonderfully strange light. But the annelids, my dear Graham, the annelids, hundreds, nay, thousands of annelids of at least 36 several kinds, some plumed and others plain. And wait until I tell you about my holothurians, my sea slugs, my sea cucumbers.
Cucumbers, aye,
said Graham, making a note.
And at the first real pause, he said,
just cast a wee glippet on this listy and give me the benefit of your lights. I've settled the dinner pretty nearly to my satisfaction, but not the seating of my guests. As well as the sea officers with their own hierarchy, there are some Highland gentlemen coming belonging to various clans, and I must take notice both of precedence within the clan and the precedence of the clans themselves, or there'll be wigs on the green. Can you imagine a MacWhirter giving place to any MacAlpine? For an informal gathering of this kind, mere army rank doesn't apply with us. Though, to be sure, the officers of the 42nd are very unwilling to yield to those of any other Scots regiment whatsoever.
You must number the chairs, and let each man draw his number from a hat. You may pass this off with a graceful, witty remark.
A graceful, witty remark.
I wish it were all over.
Sure you like your dinner once you're well set to it,
said Stephen, looking at the bill of fare.
What are bashed neeps?
Neeps, hack it with balmagowrie.
It's not so much the dinner that I wish to be over and done with, no, it's the whole of it. I shall be glad to get home to the quiet of my study and my lectures. I shall miss your company, Marchand, and yet apart from that, I shall be glad to leave. I don't like the smell of Malta. From the point of view of intelligence, you understand, there are too many people at work, and too many of them are poor, loose-tongued, clacking bodies. There are schemes for the Barbary Coast that I don't like at all. And when you consider Mehemet Ali's real sentiments with regard to the sublime port, this Red Sea business seems but a dubious undertaking. There are many things I don't like at all.
He paused, looking steadily at Machelin.
Did you ever hear of a man named Le Sueur?
André Le Sueur? He asked. Stephen considered.
I connect the name with intelligence, with Thévenot's organization, but I know nothing about him, and I've never seen him.
I saw him in Paris during the peace. One of our agents pointed him out, and I'm almost certain I recognized him in the Strada Reale today, walking about as though we were at home while you were in your booty. I turned as discreetly as I could and tried to follow him, but the crowd was too thick.
What is he like?
A small, pale man, narrow-shouldered, rather bowed, gloomy, black coat with cloth buttons, buff breeches. 45 or thereabouts. The appearance of a man of business, or a not inconsiderable merchant. Since you're not in the way, and since I've my doubts about the discretion of the Secretariat, I went straight to Mr. Ray.
Ah, and what did he say?
He listened very attentively. He's a far more intelligent man than I'd supposed. And he desired me to mention it to no one else. He's gathering all his threads to make a single, decisive coup de filet.
I wish he would succeed.
I have the impression that the French are as well installed here in Malta as we were in Toulon in 1803. No movement of ships or troops or munitions, but we knew within 24 hours.
I wish he may. But that'll not do away with the rivalry between soldiers and sailors on the island, the divided councils, the loose talk, and the perpetual coming and going of foreigners and discontented natives. Nor would the perhaps untimely zeal of the new commander-in-chief and his followers. Maybe we shall know more of that, more of the whole situation when he holds his conference. As, no doubt you're aware, he has been signalled to the west of Gozo, and a change of wind might bring him in tomorrow or the next day. I doubt it'll tell us much. A meeting of this kind with Sir Hildebrand and his soldiers present, and with several of the members seeing one another for the first time, isn't likely to produce anything but platitudes. Who's going to pour out his heart on confidential matters before strangers, whatever their credentials? I'm very sure Mr. Ray will confine himself to generalities, but I shall say nothing whatsoever. I should say nothing even if it were not for the presence of that long-eared Luby Figgins Pocock. Stephen was aware that Mr. Pocock, a distinguished Orientalist who accompanied Admiral Sir Francis Ives as adviser on Turkish and Arabic affairs, had disagreed with Professor Graham over an edition of Abul Feda, that each had written pamphlets attaining a rare degree of personal abuse, and that this might colour Graham's view of the Commander-in-Chief's eastern policies. But even so, he felt inclined to agree when Graham said, "The atmosphere in Valletta is most unhealthy. Even if Mr. Ray deals with the immediate situation, it's likely to remain most unhealthy, with divided authority at the top, ill will and rivalry at all levels, and fools in charge. And since, as I understand it, you're to remain a while, might you not do well to keep your distance and mind your physic, your natural philosophy, and your bell?"
"I might indeed," said Stephen, staring at his feet.
"But for the moment I must mind my shoes and stockings. I'm bid to an elegant soiree, to Mrs. Fielding's concert party, and must go without further loss of time. Yet I perceive that in drying they emit a most offensive smell. Do you think that by rubbing I might get them clean?"
"I doubt it," said Graham, inspecting them more closely. "There is an unctuous quality about the undried parts that precludes any such measure."
"My coat I can shift, and even my shirt and stockings," said Stephen. "But these are my only good shoes."
"You ought to have put on an old pair if you wish to go a-diving," said Professor Graham, who had not studied moral philosophy in vain. "Or even half-boots. I should not be altogether unwilling to lend you a pair, although they have silver buckles, but they must necessarily be too big."
"That's of no importance," said Stephen. "They can be stuffed with handkerchiefs, paper, lint. So long as the heels and toes press against a firm but yielding support, the external dimensions of the shoe don't signify."
"They were my grandsire's," said Professor Graham, taking them from a cloth bag. "And at that time it was usual for men to add a couple of inches to their stature by the means of cork heels."
Stephen's cello, though bulky in its padded sea-going sail-cloth case, was not a heavy instrument, nor had he any shyness about carrying it through the public streets. It was not weight or embarrassment that made him pause and gasp and sit down on steps so often, but mere agony. His theory on the size of shoes was mistaken, and it had proved to be so within a very short space of time, the evening being uncommonly warm, while his only clean wearable stockings were made not of silk but of lamb's wool. His feet, already cramped by the unnatural heels, swelled in the course of the first 200 yards, and began to chafe, blister, and grow raw, even before he reached the crowded, cheerful Strada Vescovo. His staggering progress gave the impression that he was drunk, and a little group of whores and street boys kept him company, hoping eventually to profit from this state of affairs.
"Calor rubor dolor," he said, sitting down again at a street corner under the gently lit image of St. Rocco. "This cannot go on. Yet, if I take off my shoes, I cannot carry them and the cello too. On the other hand, any of these wicked boys might run off with them, and then what should I say to Graham? Again, I am unwilling to trust the instrument to their careless hands. The bag must be nursed in both arms like a tender, ailing child. If only there were a good-humoured girl among these trumpery queens. But they seem a hard-faced set entirely. I'm on the horns of a dilemma." Yet even as he defied them, the horns, so they collapsed. A band of the Surprises Liberty men rounding St. Rocco's corner came plump upon him. They made no bones at all about carrying his shoes, and one of them, a dark, sinister forecastle hand who had almost certainly been a pirate in his youth, said he would carry the big fiddle and would like to see the sod that offered to laugh or call for a tune. The Surprises were not, as who should say, drunk, or even merry by naval standards, but they did stagger and trip over things and stop to laugh or argue from time to time, and when at last they left him at Laura Fielding's outer door, it was late. So late that as he hobbled along the passage, he heard Jack Aubrey's violin in the unseen courtyard, answered by a soft, complaining flute. "The next time I shall leave my cello in the dear creature's house," he said, as he waited there outside the door for the music to come to an end. And then, cocking his ear to the flute's most distinctive voice, "That must be a flauto d'amore. I've not heard one in a great while now." The movement closed with a conventional flourish. Stephen glided through the door, bent low in deprecation, and sat on a cool stone bench just inside the courtyard with his cello beside him. Laura Fielding at the pianoforte gave him a very welcoming smile, Captain Aubrey a stern look, and Count Muratori, now raising his flute to his lips again, a singularly vacant stare. Most of the other people were hidden from him by the lemon tree. The music was of no great importance, but once he'd slipped off his shoes it was pleasant, sitting there with the sound weaving decorative patterns in the warm, gently stirring air. The lemon tree was giving out its well-remembered scent, strong but not excessive, and on the side farthest from the lanterns, the darkest corner of the court, there was a troop of fireflies. They too weaved decorative patterns, and with a certain effort of the imagination, a little elimination of unnecessary notes and unnecessary flies, the two could be made to coincide. Ponto came pacing across, smelt Stephen in an offensively censorious way, avoided his caress, and walked off again, flinging himself down among the fireflies with a disgusted sigh. Presently, he began to lick his private parts with so strong a lashing sound that it quite overlaid a pianissimo passage for the flute, and Stephen lost the thread of the argument, such as it was. His mind drifted away to fireflies he had known, to American fireflies, and to an account a Boston entomologist had given him of their ways. According to this gentleman, the different species emitted different signals to show their willingness for sexual congress. This was natural enough, indeed a laudable practice, but what seemed less so was the fact that certain females of, say, species A, moved not by any amorous warmth but by mere voracity, would imitate the signals of species B, whose males, all unsuspecting, would descend not to a glowing nuptial couch, but to a dismal butcher's block. The music ended to a civil patter of applause. Mrs. Fielding sprang up from her piano and met him as he advanced to make his excuses. "Oh, oh," she cried, glancing down at his stockinged feet, "you have forgot your shoes." "Mrs. Fielding, joy," he said, "I shall never forget them while I live. They've killed me so cruelly. But I thought we were old enough friends not to stand upon the strictest letter of etiquette." "Of course we are," she said, squeezing his arm affectionately. "I should certainly take off my shoes in your house, were they hurting. You know everybody. Count Muratori, Colonel O'Hara, of course you do. Come and drink a glass of cold punch. Bring you your shoes, and I will put them in my bedroom." She led him into the house, and there, indeed, Stephen saw that a punch bowl had taken the place of the traditional pitchers of lemonade. Nor did innovations end here, for the Naples biscuits had given way to anchovies and little daubs of fiery paste on bread. Furthermore, Mrs. Fielding had spent some hours under the hands of a hairdresser, and in front of a well-lit looking-glass she'd done her best to improve her already very fine complexion. Stephen, his mind directed downwards to his feet and forwards to the indifferently rehearsed sonata that he was to play, wasn't distinctly aware of this, but he did notice that she had a scent upon her, and that she was wearing a flame-coloured dress remarkably low-cut. He disapproved of it. Many men were strongly moved by a pretty bosom, partly bare. Jack Aubrey had been bowled over many a time, and he thought it cruelly unfair in a woman to excite desires that she had no intention of satisfying. He disapproved of the punch, too. It was far, far too strong, and when he bit into the red paste it made him gasp again. Beneath all the fire there was a taste not unfamiliar, but unnameable within some minutes' recollection, and that was impossible, seeing that in common decency he was obliged to congratulate Mrs. Fielding on her brew, assure her that the fiery things were ambrosia, eating another to prove it, and to exchange civilities with the other guests. And it seemed to him that the atmosphere of the party was not what it usually was, which saddened him. There wasn't the same easy gaiety, conceivably because Laura Fielding was trying too hard. She seemed to be on edge. And conceivably because at least some of the men were minding her person more than their music. But when Jack Aubrey came up to him and said, "There you are, Stephen, there you are at last. How did your diving go?" his cheerfulness returned with the recollection of that glorious afternoon, and he said, "Upon my soul, Jack, it is the belle of the world. As soon as his launch brought it alongside the Edinburgh, Captain Dundas, that worthy, deserving man, called down, did I choose, to make a descent directly, because if so, he was my man. He would be," lowering his voice, "damned, if he would let me go down alone, and—" "Dear doctor, am I interrupting you?" asked Laura Fielding, handing him his score.
"Not at all, ma'am," said Stephen. "I was only telling Captain Aubrey about my diving bell, my new diving bell."
"Oh, yes, yes, your diving bell," she said. "How I long to hear about it. Let us hurry through our music, and you will tell me about it in peace. Pearls, mermaiden, sirens." Their piece was a contarini cello sonata with no more than a figured bass, and hitherto Laura Fielding had always played her part beautifully. Harmony came to her as naturally as breathing, and the music flowed from her like water from a spring. But this time they'd hardly travelled 10 bars together before she produced a chord so false that Stephen winced. Jack Muratori and Colonel O'Hara raised their eyebrows and pursed their lips, and an aged commendatore said, "Tut, tut, tut," quite loud. After the first trip, she concentrated hard. Stephen could see her pretty head bent over the keyboard, her grave, concentrated expression, her lower lip caught between her teeth. But studious application didn't suit her style at all, and she played indifferently until the end of the movement, sometimes throwing him off balance, sometimes sounding a most unfortunate note. "I'm so sorry," she said. "I will try to do better now." Alas for the word.
The adagio called for subtle phrasing, and it called in vain. She cast him several apologetic looks until a particularly wild aberration made him pause, his bow in the air, when she laid her hands in her lap and said, "Shall we go back to the beginning?" "By all means," said Stephen. But it was not a successful experiment. Between them they slowly murdered poor Contarini, Maturin now playing as badly as his partner. And when his A string broke with a solemn twang 2/3 of the way through the adagio, there was a general feeling of relief. After this, Colonel O'Hara played some modern pieces on the pianoforte with great fire and dash, but the evening never really recovered from the blow. "Mrs. Fielding is not in spirits," observed Stephen, standing by the lemon tree with Jack Aubrey. "Not in real spirits, that is," he added, since she could be seen talking and laughing at a great rate. "No," said Jack, "she's grieving about her husband, no doubt. She mentioned him earlier in the day." He was looking at her through the leaves with great goodwill and commiseration. He always esteemed women who refused him kindly. And Laura Fielding, though somewhat harassed, was unusually fine this evening in her flame-coloured dress. "It is my belief she would welcome the sight of our backs," said Stephen. "As soon as it's decent, I shall make my adieus. Perhaps, indeed, I may take up my shoes, Graham's shoes. Even now, ask, may I leave my cello and slip away unseen?" His last words were covered by the laughter of a group of men the other side of the tree and by the approach of Captain Wagstaff, who hailed Jack in a rather loud, familiar voice, asking if he'd et many of these fiery red things. Stephen padded away into the house, where he found Mrs. Fielding carefully filling glasses with punch from a kitchen jug. Her expression changed to one of the fondest welcome. She said, "Be a tesoro and help me with the tray." And then, coming close, she whispered in his ear, "I'm trying to get rid of them, but they will not go. Tell them it is a good night hat. Cap, I mean." "I was just about to take my leave," he said. "Oh, no," she said, amused. "You are not to go now. Oh, no, you are to stay. I must consult you. Have a glass of punch and eat one of the marzipan. I've kept them for you." "To tell you the truth, my dear, I believe I've eaten all I can for one day. Just a half, and I will eat it with you." They carried out the trays, he the larger one with the glasses, and she another on which he recognised his old friends, the Naples biscuits. As they made their round, Mrs. Fielding made pretty speeches, thanking her guests for having come and for having played so charmingly. Yet still they wouldn't go away, but stood there, laughing unusually loud and talking with an unusual freedom. If, earlier in the evening, she'd behaved with a certain wantonness, perhaps artificial wantonness, she regretted it now. But present formality and reserve didn't do away with the effect. Liberty tended to give way to license. And Wagstaff, looking from Jack to Stephen, said, "Upon my word, Doctor, you are in luck. There are men who'd give a great deal for your place as butler." It wasn't until she'd had a private word with the commendatore that they began to make their farewells in small, slow groups, and even then Wagstaff stuck interminably in the open door, telling an anecdote that had just occurred to him, an anecdote whose obviously improper denouement was obliged to be stifled by the companions who led him away, at last, still laughing, down the long, arched, echoing corridor to the street, where an unseen watcher ticked them off on his list. At last, only Aubrey and Maturin were left, Jack lingering to help his friend limp home. He was unusually aware of the fact that he was a man and that Laura Fielding was a woman, but he still regarded her with great benevolence, as one of the angelic kind, until he heard her ask him to shut
Ponto into the farther court. He hates to go, but he will do anything for you. And then, as he passed through the outer door, to close it for fear of cats. The dear doctor wasn't leaving yet. He was going to indulge her by staying for a while. And this, she said, with a smile at Stephen. The smile that Jack intercepted and that gave him a blow as sharp and sudden as a pistol shot. For although he might mistake signals addressed to himself, he could scarcely be mistaken about those flying for another man. He concealed his feelings with a very fair show of equanimity, returning his best thanks for a most enjoyable evening, and hoping that he might have the honour of waiting upon Mrs. Fielding again in the very near future. But there was no deceiving Ponto, who fixed nervous, placating eyes on Jack's face, and who walked obediently off without a word, his ears drooping, to imprisonment in the cistern court, although he loathed sleeping anywhere but by his mistress's bed. "For fear of cats, upon my word of honour," said Jack, pulling the outer door to behind him. "I should never have believed it of Stephen." Stephen himself was standing a little uncertainly among the many glasses and little plates scattered about the courtyard when Laura reappeared, equipped to deal with the disorder. "I will just make a clean sweep," she said. "Go indoors into my bedroom. I have put some fiamme and a pot of wine." "Where is Giovanna?" he asked. "She does not stay here at night," said Laura with a smile. "I shall not be long." It was perfectly usual to receive in one's bedroom in France and in most countries that had adopted French manners. And Stephen had been in Mrs. Fielding's bedroom before this. In bad weather, her parties overflowed into it from her little sitting room. But never had he seen it look so pleasant. In front of the sofa, set cornerwise at the far end, stood a low table of gleaming brass with a lamp upon it. A lamp that shed a pool of white light on the floor and a smaller round on the ceiling, while its translucent red shade filled the rest of the room with a rosy glow, particularly agreeable on the bare, whitewashed walls. Beyond the sofa, nothing could be seen very clearly. The curtained bed loomed vaguely on the left, and there were some chairs with boxes on them scattered about. But as he sat down, he did notice that a large and hideous picture of Mr. Fielding had been removed. He remembered it well. The lieutenant, he was acting first of the Phoenix at the time, was shown in striped pantaloons and a round hat, holding a speaking trumpet in one hand and the broken starboard forebrace in the other, as he guided the ship over a reef in a West Indian hurricane. Most of it had been painted by a shipmate, and Jack asserted that there wasn't a rope out of the exact position you would expect in such a blow. But the face had been put in by a professional hand. It was a perfectly human face, energetic, sombre, humourless, and it made a shocking contrast with the wooden theatrical figure. In a woman with so delicate a taste as Mrs. Fielding, only a high degree of devotion could have given it house room. The dish or plate next to the decanter of marsala on the brass table gave a much more accurate notion of what she liked. A red-figured Greek pinax from Sicily. It was chipped and repaired, but its cheerful nymphs still danced beneath their tree with infinite grace, as they'd done these 2,000 years or more. "Yet how does it come about that you put those two reds together?" he asked, looking from the nymphs to the rounds of fiery paste. "A horrid clash indeed." Then he contemplated his feet for a while, before returning to the paste and its probable ingredients, apart from red pepper. "What an elusive thing smell can be at times," he said. "One may know it intimately well, yet be quite unable to place it."
Again he brought his nose close to the dish, narrowing his eyes as he sniffed. And instantly, to contradict his words, the scent gave up its name. Cantharides, more commonly known as Spanish fly, a substance occurring in the wing cases of a thin, iridescent, yellowish-green beetle with a powerful smell, familiar to every southern naturalist and used externally for blistering as a counter-irritant, and sometimes internally to arouse sexual desire. The most active ingredient of love filters. Spanish fly, is it, poor dear? He said. And then, having considered the implications for a moment, he said, in all likelihood she got it from Anagoni, an apothecary notorious for the adulteration of his wares. But even so, I dread to think of those men roaming Valletta like a herd of hungry bulls. I very distinctly perceive the effects in myself, and no doubt they will presently increase. Laura Fielding came in at last. It was not clearing away alone that kept her, for now she had a blue sash on, making her slim waist look even slimmer, and she'd rearranged her hair. But she was obviously nervous as she sat down next to Stephen, much more so than when there'd been a courtyard full of guests. She said brightly, "Why, you've drunk nothing. I will pour you a glass of wine while you finish these," advancing the pinax with its red rounds. "A glass of wine with all my heart," said Stephen, "but if I may, I'll eat one of those little March pancakes with it." "I can refuse you nothing," she said, "and we'll fetch them at once. And while you're up, would you pass by the piece of chalk now?" called Stephen after her, the piece of chalk with which Laura reminded herself of her day's appointments. He too was nervous. What little experience he'd had of women in the course of his career had, upon the whole, been discouraging. He knew he must tread very carefully. Yet he was by no means sure just how he should direct his steps. "There," she said, coming back, "marchpane and the piece of chalk." She took the decanter and said, "We shall have to share the glass. It is the only clean one left. Do you dislike drinking with me?" "I do not," he said. And they sat there without speaking for some minutes, nibbling cakes and silently passing the wine glass to and fro. A friendly, companionable pause in spite of the tensions on either side. "Listen," he said at last, "was it as a medical man that you wished to consult me?" "Yes," she said. "That is to say, no. I will tell you. But first, let me say how sorry, oh, so sorry I am, I played so badly." In some detail she told him how the first blunder had led to others, how she had begun to have to think, and how fatal thought was to her fingers. "Is there anything I can do to make you forgive me?" she asked, laying her hand upon his knee and blushing. "Sure, my dear, I forgive you with all my heart." "Then you must give me a kiss." He gave her a kiss, a genuinely abstracted peck, for his mind was elsewhere. He knew very well that, although he'd fortified himself by regarding her as a patient, he was near his limit. And what brought him nearer to unchastity was his hatred of behaving like a scrub, for the insult of his apparent indifference was growing more blatant every minute. Nevertheless, he reached across and took the piece of chalk, saying, "Will I tell you about my bell, so?" "Oh, yes," she cried, "I am longing to hear about your bell." "This, you must understand, is the bell seen sideways," he said, drawing on the lamp-lit floor. "Its height is 8 feet. The window at the top is a yard across, as near as no matter. The width here, where the bench runs across, is a little better than 4 feet 6, and the whole contains 59 cubic feet of air." 59 cubic feet, said Laura Fielding. She'd had a very long, very hard day, and a more attentive ear might have caught a note of despair under the bright, intelligent interest. 59 cubic feet to begin with, of course, said Stephen, drawing two dwarfish figures on the bench, and adding in parenthesis, there sat the worthy Captain Dundas, and there sat I, elbow room galore, as you see. But naturally, as the bell sank, as it was lowered away a couple of fathoms, the water rose, compressing the air, so that we felt a certain pringling in our ears. When it reached the bench, we raised our feet thus, setting his own on the sofa, and plucked the cord, the signal for the barrel. He drew the barrel with its two bungholes and its leather hose travelling down guidelines to the lower edge of the bell, explaining that it was not quite to scale. Down it came, the good barrel, compressing its own air as it came, you see. We seized the hose, and the moment we raised it above the surface of the water in the barrel, you understand, the compressed air rushed into the bell with inconceivable force, and the water sank from the bench to the lower rim. And so the barrels came down one after another, and so the dear bell sank, the light growing a little dim, but not too dim to read or write. Oh, no. We had lead slabs to write on with an iron stylus, which we sent up with a string. And to let out the vitiated air so that it was always fresh, there was a little cock at the top. Will I draw you my little cock? Eventually, he brought the bell to the bottom, and making a last effort, she said, the bottom of the sea, Mother of God. And what did you find there? Worms, he cried. Such worms, marine worms in great abundance. And it was there that I made an inconsiderate step into the fetid mud of ages, yet it scarcely disturbed any but the nearest. These were of the plumed kind, known as... At the beginning of his account of the Maltese annelids, he noticed that her bosom was heaving. He knew very well that it wasn't heaving for him, but he didn't realise that grief was the cause, until he reached the bizarre mating habits of Polychaeta rubra, when, to his intense embarrassment and distress, he saw tears coursing down her cheeks. His exposition faltered. Their eyes met. She gave him a painfully artificial smile, and then her chin trembled and she broke into passionate weeping at last. He took her hand, saying meaningless, comforting words. For an instant she was on the point of snatching it away, but then she clung hard and between her sobs she said, "Must I go down on my knees? How can you be so hard? Cannot I make you love me?" He didn't answer until she was calmer, and then said, "Of course you cannot. How can you be so simple, my dear? Surely you must know that these things are reciprocal or they're nothing. It's not possible that you should be enamoured of my person. You may have kindly feelings for me. I hope so, indeed. But as for love or desire or anything of a stronger nature, so there's not a breath of it in you." "Oh, but there is, and I will prove it." "Listen," he said firmly, patting her knee with an authoritative hand. "I am a medical man, and I know for a fact that you are quite unmoved." "How can you tell?" she cried, blushing violently. "Never mind. It is a fact, and I can measure the degree of your indifference by the strength of my own desire. Believe me, I do most ardently wish to enjoy the last favours, to possess you, as people so absurdly say, but not on those terms." "Not at all?" she asked. And when he shook his head, she wept even more bitterly. But still she clung to his hand as if it were her only anchor. She made no coherent reply when he said, It's clear that you wish me to do something of a particular nature. For a woman of your kind to propose such a sacrifice, it must be unusually important and certainly most confidential. Will you tell me now what it is? All he could gather from her disconnected words was that she could not, she dared not, that it was too dangerous, there was nothing to tell. He was sitting in a somewhat cramped position in the corner of the sofa, with his stockinged foot tucked under him, and Mrs. Fielding pressed against his side, trembling convulsively from time to time. His crooked knee was cruelly uncomfortable, and he longed to reach out for the glass of wine, but he felt that the crisis might well come in the next few minutes, and he continued to wonder aloud what the nature of the service might be. His words about medical certificates, supplies, the release of impressed men, and so on, were meant to provide little more than a comforting thoroughbase or continuo. His mind was much more taken up with gauging his patient's state of mind and body, because, quite apart from Jack's remark and the absence of the picture, he was almost sure that he had the solution. Her sobbing stopped. She sniffed, breathing easier, but by no means quite evenly. "Would it be to do with your husband, my dear?" he asked.
"Oh, yes," she cried despairingly,
and her tears ran fast again. Yes, they had him in prison. They would kill him if she didn't succeed. She dared not tell them she'd failed. They'd been pressing her to move quickly. Oh, wouldn't dear Dr. Maturin be kind to her? They would kill him otherwise.
Nonsense, said Stephen, standing up. They'll do nothing of the kind. They've been deceiving you. Listen, have you any coffee in the kitchen?
Over their pot of coffee and rather stale pieces of bread and olive oil, the miserable story came out piece by piece. Charles Fielding's unfortunate position. His letters, her collecting of information, nothing wicked, only to do with marine insurance, but confidential. The sudden, much graver mission on which her husband's life depended. They told her that Dr. Maturin had connections in France with whom he corresponded in code. It was all concerned with finance and perhaps smuggling. She was to win his confidence and obtain the addresses and the codes. Yes, she knew the name of the man who had brought her Charles's last letter. He was Paolo Moroni, a Venetian, and she'd seen him from time to time in Valletta. She thought he was a merchant. But she neither knew the names nor the appearance of the other men who spoke to her. They changed. There were perhaps three or four of them. Sometimes she was sent for, and she could get into touch with them by leaving a paper with the time on it at a wine merchant's house. She was always required to go to St. Simon's, to the third confessional on the left at a stated hour, there to give her information and to receive her letters if there were any. The man in the confessional did not pull back the little door like a priest, but spoke through the lattice, so she never saw his face. There was one she did know, however, because she had seen him talking with Moroni, a man who spoke good, but not quite perfect Italian, with a strong Neapolitan accent. He was often in the confessional. Yes, she thought, he knew that she knew him. Certainly she could describe him, but she never would while Charles was in their hands. It might be unlucky. She would never do anything that might do Charles any harm. She was worried about his letters, however. They had been strange these last weeks, as though he were unwell or unhappy. What did Dr. Maturin think? There was nothing private. They had to be sent unsealed, and she did not mind showing them. Mr. Fielding wrote a clear, strong hand, and his style was equally straightforward. Although his letters were necessarily discreet, they gave a sense of powerful, direct, uncomplicated affection. Stephen hadn't read two before he felt a liking for him.
But, as Laura had said, the more recent were shorter, and in spite of the fact that they used many of the same phrases and expressions, they seemed laboured. Could he be writing against his will from dictation? Or is it not himself at all, wondered Stephen. If he's died, or if they've killed him, Laura Fielding's life will not be worth a Brummagem groat once she knows it for a fact. No chief of intelligence could let her run about Malta knowing what she knows without he has a very strong hold over her. And a woman is so easy to kill without a hidden motive being suspected, since it can always be coupled with a rape. Aloud, he said, "Clearly I don't know him as you know him, but a cold or a slight indisposition or a lowness of spirits could answer for all this and more." "I am so happy you think so," she said. "I am sure you are right, a cold or a slight indisposition. But attend to me now," he said after a long pause. "This Moroni and his friends have been led into the strangest mistake. I have nothing whatever to do with finance or smuggling or insurance by land or sea. I give you my sacred word of honour. I swear by the four Gospels and my hope of salvation that you might have searched my papers forever without finding a smell of a code or an address in France." "Oh," she said. And he knew that although his words were literally true, she had pierced through to their essential falsity, and that she didn't believe him. "But, however," he went on, "I believe I know how this mistake has arisen. I have a friend whose occupation brings him into touch with confidential affairs. We have very often been seen together, and these men, or more probably their informants, have confounded us, taking the one for the other. Yet there is something so amiable about a lady's concern for her husband and he a prisoner, that I am persuaded my friend will furnish us with what is needed to satisfy Moroni. I don't say that it'll really be useful to Moroni, but that it will satisfy him in the matter of his own penetration and of your success. It will satisfy him that I am your lover. I will come here when you're alone. You will come to my rooms, perhaps wearing your maid's faldetta, and you will present the documents as the fruit of your labours." There was the light of dawn in the little courtyard as he took his leave, but his mind was so busy that he didn't notice it. Nor did he notice the change in the wind. "If Ray is the man I think he is, all this may be unnecessary," he reflected, walking along the dark corridor with Graham's shoes in his hand. "But if not, or if this is a different, quite unconnected organisation, how far can I go without compromising Laura Fielding? A thousand delightful forms of very damaging false information to be conveyed through her had occurred to him even before he reached the outer door. And as he opened it, the tired watcher on the other side of the street saw him smiling in the early light. "Lucky, lecherous dog," said the watcher, pulling his hat over his eyes. At the same moment, the air shook with the first of the guns saluting the arrival of the commander-in-chief, and a thousand pigeons flew up into the pure, pale blue sky.